Dear Brother Gordon and my dear brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ our Lord, it is lovely for Lorna and Sister Ruth Onley to be with you this morning and to come before these emblems that remind us so tangibly of what our life is all about. I was interested just the other day to go through Daniel and just say, what's Daniel got to do with Christ? And I found it was an interesting exercise. Well, in chapter 2 that we all know so well, where's Christ? He's there, isn't he? He certainly is there. Because it says in verse 35 and 36, then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. He's there, all right. In fact, he quotes those very words in Matthew chapter 21, when he asks the people of his day, well, what shall happen to those workers in the field that had so maltreated God's servants? And he said that whoso falleth on this stone will be ground, but upon whom that stone fall, it will grind him to powder. And of course, it was straight out of Daniel chapter 2. So he knew what that chapter was about, and he was the centre feature of that prophecy. What about chapter 3? It's interesting to note in verse 25 that he answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, true, four men walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. You can't feel that that's just an accident of words, can you? Because it was by the means of that fourth person, as it were, by that Son of God, that people would be able to go through the fires of life, the fires of death, and they would be able to be without hurt. What about chapter 4? How much has Daniel got to do with our Sunday morning? Well, it's quite intriguing to just see that, in fact, Christ stretches through all the record of Daniel, sometimes very overtly and other times just peeping through, as it were, through the record. In Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17, we read this: matters by the decree of the watchers. This is the key verse of Daniel. It's what it's all about. The demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men. That's a good summation of Daniel, isn't it? The prophecy. And giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men. Rotherham's translation puts that much more significantly when it says, setteth up over it him who is set at naught among men. Well, that's the very phrase that's used of the Lord, isn't it? And in the ultimate expression of verse 17, he is the feature. Setteth up over it whom he will. And that's indeed, in the end, the Lord Jesus Christ. What a beautiful thing. What about in chapter 7? I saw in the night visions, verse 13, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. He receives the glory of the universe. There was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. No doubt about that one, is there? That's got to be Christ. His ascendancy in verse 13, where he receives from the Father that power that he spoke of. All things in heaven and earth are given unto me, he said after he was raised from the dead. In fact, he quotes those words. He quotes it to his very judgment, his judges that were making inquisition about what in fact he had said or what he hadn't said. And he said, hereafter ye shall see the Son of Man coming in the glory of his Father. So chapter 7 is definitely centred upon him. And of course this must really be the case, but it's an interesting exercise. Look at chapter 8. It speaks of the new Roman power developing, and it says in verse 11, yea, he magnified himself to this horn power that was developing in the west. He magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And Jesus quotes those words to Pilate, effectively, because Pilate said, don't you know that I have power to give life or to take it away? And Jesus replied, you would have no power except it were given thee from above. A host was given him against the daily sacrifice, says verse 12. And Jesus said, so that he therefore that delivered thee has the greater sin. And verse 12 goes on to say that that happened, the AD 70 calamity, by reason of transgression. Isn't that powerful? So the Lord knew that passage, and he knew that it was about himself, was able to apply it wondrously at the right time. Chapter 9. Well, this is an easy one, isn't it? In chapter 9 and verse 25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks and so on. This is a prophecy of the 70 weeks. And of course, it comes to the very times of Jesus. That's why it was given. After 62 weeks, verse 26, shall Messiah be cut off? He would be the answer to all of Israel's problems. Daniel asked for a restoral of Jerusalem, and he got more than that. He got the restoral of life itself and a new Jerusalem greater than he ever imagined. Chapter 12, verse 1, well, we always knew that that was about Christ. That time shall Michael, he that is like God, stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was. So in that wonderful little way, we can see that Christ is right through the book of Daniel, and when the centre of the chapter comes out, it's Christ, God's appointed son, that is at the centre of it. In Daniel chapter 6, this wonderful man, he was really, in, as far as history is concerned, there's very few people that could ever be described to have the status and the significance of Daniel. I mean, he was the one that was allowed to sketch the whole story of the Gentiles. What an amazing privilege that was, that he could, just as a human being, he could sketch that to the king of the world as he was then. What an amazing blessing that was. Incredible blessing. And there's no one else that's ever done that. And yet in this chapter 6, he was caught by what seemed to be an unvariable law of the kingdom of Cyrus, of the kingdom of the Persians. And they reiterate that time and again, don't they? Look at verse 9. Now, O king, establish the decree. This is chapter 6 and verse 8. Establish the decree and sign the writing. And with gnawing reiteration, he says, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Verse 12, it comes up again. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. And it's repeated again in verse 15, lest he should weaken. So a man of perfect righteousness, as far as they could see, God would know better than that. But as far as they could see, a man that was unimpeachable, he was nevertheless caught in this bind because there was this unalterable law. Does that remind you of somebody? Indeed it does. And this whole chapter is like that. Christ is behind this chapter right through. And it's an amazing thing to just think about how Daniel was at this stage. He's no longer the young man. He's very close to 90. This is now in the kingdom of Cyrus, over which Darius is one of his rulers. Please Darius to set over the kingdom. Babylon fell in chapter 5, and now Darius reorganizes Babylon and all the kingdom. 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. Esther, the book of Esther tells us there was 127 provinces. And he appointed three special people over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first. That confirms our understanding in our Sunday school class, doesn't it? That Daniel was seen as exceptionally remarkable. Three presidents of over 127 provinces. I mean, you really have to be somebody, don't you? And then to be the top of those three is just an astounding thing. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, verse 3, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. He's not going to have just, you know, these number of provinces. He'll be in charge of the whole scene, the prime minister of the land. He'd already been in that position when Babylon was on top. But now Babylon has gone down and Persia's come up, and lo and behold, he's in the top seat again. How wondrous the works of the God of Israel. How the little colonies of Jews that were spread among the rivers of the Euphrates, the little streams that ran out from it, how they must have shaken their heads in just sheer wonder as they could see that God was working with their nation again in very powerful evidence. Why, for some years, perhaps decades, he'd been in the shades. Belshazzar had no need for him, he thought, until the last night. And then he was drawn out of that obscurity, and he had the golden chain, he had the purple robe, and it was his really to hand over Babylon. What an amazing thing God had done. Here was this man that came as a little boy, 17 years of age, and immediately Babylon took hold of him and thought, I'll make you in my mould. Here's my king, here's my king's meat and my king's drink. And we'll conform you that you will help the cause of Babylon and you'll grow to be a real Babylonian, a Chaldean of excellency with all the skills and knowledge of the Chaldeans. You know, I think that Daniel read that like a book. And I think he read it before he ever got into that position. When he was back there in the Jewish situation, under Josiah, because Josiah would see that, Josiah received the certain knowledge the invasion was coming. Huldah told him that won't be redressed. The invasion is coming in your lifetime. It will come, but you'll be taken out of the scene. What do you think Josiah would have done? What would you? If we had a message like that, well, I think we've got a message like that, haven't we? Judgment's coming. What are we doing? Well, I think what he did was train people that had the same spirit that he had. And they were people like Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Like little Micaiah that took the message from the house of Gemariah of what Daniel had spoken and spoke in the very presence of the princes of the land. What a lad. What an amazing boy. Like those sons of Shaphan that always come to the fore in the record of Jeremiah. Amazing lads. Where did they come from? Somebody inspired those boys to have a rock-like faith. And I think that when Daniel came and he saw the Ishtar Gate and all those great walls, my dear brothers and sisters, I don't think that he was quaking with fear. I think he loathed the place for all that it meant. Although they've been told to pray for Babylon, his heart rested in Jerusalem and he prayed towards that place. And so as he went into that city, he would know that if he was to give an inch, it would end up being a mile. And eventually his example would be lost to his people. But he's not a little boy now. He's not a young man. He's a man in his late 80s. And he's put over all of this realm again. Would you ever appoint a man in his 80s to such a position? The oldest president America ever had began his term when he was 70. And that was considered to be almost a freak thing, wasn't it? Repeated it again at 74 years of age. But almost 90, it must have seemed to Daniel, a most remarkable man. He was a man very close to natural death in terms of normal human life. And these men saw these princes and presidents. They were offended by his appointment. Who else could Cyrus have appointed? It was Cyrus that handed over the kingdom with a gold chain. Third in the kingdom, but Nabonidus, the father of Belshazzar, he's gone. Belshazzar lost his life that night, and rightly so. And he would have handed that kingdom over. So it was absolutely right that he should do that. He could not ignore Daniel. Now, Daniel, my dear friends, is not a proud man, was he? A tremendous man of faith that would have seen the hand of God that picked him up from all these lost older years and suddenly put him onto the theatre of great activity. In fact, in the most prominent position. And now this group of jealous men have locked him in. What's he going to do? What was the lesson of his life? At the end of that chapter 1, remember, it says, "Now Daniel persisted, he continued, until the reign of Cyrus, when Babylon was eclipsed, that tried to make him in their mould." Daniel was still going. He would have felt that with all the wonder that we can perhaps see in it this morning. 70 years was the ascendancy of Babylon. 70 years was the exile. The same 70 years was the exile of Israel. And he's still there. And now he's got a challenge in front of him. His prayer was to open his window and pray towards Jerusalem. But the decree obviously was intended directly against that. They knew who did it. They knew why they came to the king. It wasn't because of the king's honour. It was because they wanted to get this man that was a foreigner and an old man. And he was in their place of power and they didn't have that closeness to the kingdom of Persia that he had. They could find, however, none occasion nor fault in him. Verse 4. Even his administration at the age of, shall we say, 87, 88 years of age, perhaps it was a few more, even his administration was faultless. What an amazing man he was. But the record's got echoes coming out of it, hasn't it? A faultless man caught by an unalterable law. For as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. And so they set this plot. And when Daniel knew this, verse 10, what did he do? I just think verse 10 is a very beautiful verse, isn't it? Can you see him? He hears about the decree. He knows exactly to whom it's directed. He went into his house. When he knew the writing was signed, you sort of feel there's a calmness there, a deliberation, and his windows being opened in the chamber toward Jerusalem. He kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and he prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. He wasn't the slightest bit moved. Now, he didn't have to pray there, did he? He could have snuck behind a curtain. He could have pulled the bedclothes over him and nobody would have known. Now, recently we were in a restaurant and there was a couple over the way. And as they partook of their meal, they took hold of each other's hands and they prayed quite deliberately in the restaurant. I just happened to notice and I thought, good on them. It's not that often that you'll see people actually show such an open gesture of belief in God and thankfulness to God. You know, sometime before that, I remember that somebody had said to me when we were going for a meal in a restaurant, "Well, give thanks here in the car." And we did. It wasn't what we normally did, but I felt uncomfortable about that later. I thought, why did we bother to sort of do it in the car as though somebody might see us? This man didn't mind, did he? David had said, "Evening, morning, and at even will I pray unto thee." Daniel had picked that up from David's words in Psalm 55. And when the pressure was on, he never changed. And I find that tremendously inspiring for our own lives, because we're in a world of terrific change, aren't we? You just can't help feel the pressures. It just comes from everywhere. All the style of our life is challenged. People that used to sit around a table and have a lovely meal together, and Dad was at the top, and the children were there, cleaned up. We had to wash our hands and look tidy for the meal. And Mum was there, and she was cherished, and jobs were done, not by her, but by the children after, and Father was in full control. Where do you see that scene today? Tremendous change. If the children are even there in the house, perhaps back in their bedroom because they've got a test tomorrow, and that's more important than being at the table of their father and their mother. And of course, the readings come after that, don't they? But we always used to do that. Probably most of us here were brought up like that, as we did before time. And I think that's just something we have to take home today. We do this every Sunday. We don't dare change that. We take of bread and wine, and we do it every Sunday as we did aforetime. And pray God we ever will. And if it was a sanctified time then, so it is now. And if it was right that we came with minds prepared, so it is now. As we did aforetime. What if Daniel had have changed? You think of it from the point of view of what that meant to the people in the colonies. I mean, I suppose some of them would have said, well, Daniel, there's a way of getting out of that. You don't have to be caught by that one. They just set it up to beat you. He knew that better than they did. But he didn't change his course of life. He stuck to it. And when the scene was all finished, the king of Persia, was saying to all companies of people that the God of Daniel is the God of life. And with him are the issues of life. But what if he had have done his prayers underneath his blanket and had got away with it? That message would never have sounded through the 127 provinces of Persia. And it's a tremendous inspiration, this chapter. What happens here is a terrific inspiration for us in the latter days. Never been such times, my dear brothers and sisters, where the world's changed so much. Never. Have pity for me. I have pity for everyone who's living in this world in that sense. Because it is hard to go against the trends of the current. But Daniel had it even harder. Death the sword was over his head, effectively, wasn't it? And he could see that they thought they had him. But he never changed his way of life. Do you remember that the Lord did the same thing? He knew they were ready to get him. And do you remember it says that he went down to the Brook Kidron where prayer was wont to be made? It was a practice he had with his disciples. It was also in the days of David. The phrase is actually used where Hushai met, didn't he? And David met Hushai at a similar place where prayer was wont to be made. The Lord didn't go somewhere else. He went to Gethsemane, he knew they were coming. What if we didn't have the pages of Gethsemane? What a loss that would be. How would he have managed it on the cross if he hadn't managed it in the garden? So the continuity of our way of life is not something to be easily put aside. Our young ones are looking at us. Is he the same person? Is Auntie so-and-so the same person? Is Grandpa the same person that he used to be? When I read of earlier brethren and sisters in Christ, is Grandpa the same today as he was? And you know, we all did that. When we think about our grandparents, that's exactly how we think about them. They were remarkably stable, always the same, always an interest in you, always an interest in the truth. My grandpa used to come with a little rose in his button here. Always the same little rose, every Sunday. I still remember that. He used to come around on Wednesdays and he had this patched up old coat, you know, but he didn't care. Ride his bike around. He didn't worry, but it was Grandpa. But he was as solid as a rock when it came to the truth. And, you know, I look back on those things and I find them as tremendous stability for my own life, because we live in such a world of many things. Tremendous indulgence. Nothing's too much trouble to find in this world. So Daniel stuck to it as the old man. And eventually that message would have gone out down the little villages along the river, and the people said, did he really do that? Why didn't he just close the door, close the windows? Do it in the closet. He could pray wherever he liked. But he didn't. That was his practice. It held him in good stead. He stood to it. And so they came to the king because they knew the king really loved Daniel. And when the king heard these words, verse 14, and he knew then what the whole idea of this decree was, he was so displeased with himself. Why did I ever concede it? It was his pride they caught. They couldn't beat Daniel, but they could certainly beat Darius. But now he could see they'd played with his pride. And he was displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he laboured till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Now, I wonder what he did. He would have tried every diplomatic opportunity. He would have perhaps got hold of this group that might be a little bit more favourable. See if he could get some leniency. No leniency there. And he'd go and do everything he could, wouldn't he? To try and secure Daniel's life. But they had him. Verse 15, then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is this, that no decree nor statute which the king establisheth may be changed. And you can feel there, can't you, the whole similar grip that the elders of the Jews had over Pilate when three times he had declared his innocency and they said, we have no king but Caesar. You be loyal to Rome yourself. That's what they said to him. And this is exactly the same spirit. You be loyal to the laws of the Medes and Persians, when they could see he might falter. Amazingly parallel, isn't it? But the king seems to have believed more about Daniel than we might have thought. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel, verse 16, and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel, look at that. Thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. Does your boss know what your religion is? Does your employer, does he know what your God is? Does he know your interest in him? Does he know that you patronize your God above all things? So much so did this amazing king see that in Daniel, that he knew that Daniel would get out of this despite these other men. That's an amazing observation, isn't it? He didn't just know that Daniel had a different God or that he was a Jew that had been taken out of some other country, but he knew that that God would deliver him. What a remarkable thing that is, my dear brothers and sisters. Thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. And that's true for us today. Let our people know that we mix with, that we see from day to day, our neighbours over the fence. Let them know that our God will surely deliver, and they can be in that as well. So a stone was brought. Look at verse 17. There it all goes again, doesn't it? A stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. There the echoes become profoundly remarkable. I wonder what he thought when he was in the dungeon. I wonder if he thought something like what Jeremiah sketches in Lamentations chapter 3. Because he was thrown, wasn't he, into a similar circumstance. In chapter 3 of Lamentations, he says, they have cut off my life, verse 53, they have cut off my life in the dungeon, and cast a stone upon me. Waters flowed over mine head. Then I said, I am cut off in total darkness. I called upon thy name, O Lord, out of the low dungeon. Thou hast heard my voice. Hide not thine ear at my breathing, at my cry. Thou drewest near in the day that I called upon thee. Thou saidst, fear not. O Lord, thou hast pleaded the causes of my soul. Thou hast redeemed my life. O Lord, thou hast seen my wrong. Judge thou my cause. Thou hast seen all their vengeance and all their imaginations against me. And Darius could see, as clearly as Pilate could see, that they had done this because of envy. But he had confidence, despite the seal, despite the stone. And so verse 18, the king can't sleep. That's how much Daniel meant to him. Not just a good public servant, but someone he truly loved. The king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Don't give me any food. Not interested in it. Neither instruments of music brought before him, as might be the normal case. And his sleep went from him. He was so perturbed. And he rose very early in the morning. You can hear the echoes of the very early in the morning, can't you? And went in haste unto the den of lions, which obviously was like a place of absolute death. And when he came to the den, did he just look inside? Did he look to see if there's any stirring, living person? No, he doesn't. He cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel. He said to Daniel. He doesn't know whether Daniel's there. Might just be bones. But he's convinced that it won't be. He said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God. What a wonderful thing to say. Is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions? Before he ever got there, my dear brothers and sisters, before he could ever see the evidence one way or the other, he was sure that Daniel would hear what he said. He said to Daniel, what an amazing statement. And from the echo of that dungeon, with the lions all grouped around, their jaws, as it were, muzzled by the angel, there came these words, O King, live forever. My God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me. This, my dear brothers, is a man almost 90 years of age. Can you hear that? My God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lion's mouth, as it came reverberating up the column, that they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O King, have I done no hurt. What an amazing man he was. In the early morning, it's still dark. Perhaps he couldn't see him if he'd look for him even, because it was so dark. And Darius' reaction is that of an immensely relieved person, a lover of Daniel. Then was the king exceedingly glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel out of the den. So he was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he was justified by his faith. New Testament teaching, isn't it? Abrahamic teaching. Because he believed in his God. He didn't do a thing in the lion's den, did he? What could he do? Bind up the lions? Destroy them like Samson or David? There's too many of them. It was an unseemly thing to even imagine. God sent his angel and clamped them. The power of death was finished in that grave where he was thrown. And the echoes were wonderfully clear. It's just as if it's a New Testament chapter almost, isn't it? And those that sought his ill went the same way as those in AD 70 that had sought the death of the Lord Jesus Christ. The king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions. Them, their children and their wives, they're all in it together. They knew what was going on, and the lions had the mastery of them, and break all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den. Ranging lions, just reaching up to get these bodies, one after the other. And Daniel had been all in the middle of that, my dear friend, starving lions. Could you possibly imagine it? And he comes out without a hair touched. Well, the effect was the proclamation of the gospel from the very top point of the nation. King Darius wrote unto all people, nations and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. Before we go on, that's not the first time we read that in Daniel, is it? Nebuchadnezzar did the same thing. Chapter 4 is his chapter in the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar wrote it. Let's just have a look at some of the language of chapter 4. At the end of the days, verse 34 of Daniel 4, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honoured him that liveth for ever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. He's learnt something from Daniel 2, hasn't he? That the Most High ruleth in the kingdoms of men. He's got it absolutely right. It's in this chapter that those words are declared. The most famous phrase in Daniel, in the book of Daniel, is his words. Chapter 4, verse 17. Here it is again. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, generation to generation. Mine's not. There'll be gold, and there'll be silver, and there'll be brass, and there'll be iron. And then there'll be a mixed situation at the end before the stone comes. But his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. The king Nebuchadnezzar the gold is spelling out the gospel of the kingdom. What an amazing thing. But in this sixth chapter, it's gone on to the next kingdom. Surely Daniel did, in fact, determine what these kingdoms were to be. And it's a remarkable thing to see that, in fact, he was in two of them in which he exercised virtually that authority. He gave those records in chapter 2, and he saw out one and saw in the other, and both of those kings came to recognize the gospel. What a powerful book. What a wondrous book. I make a decree, verse 26, that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, the God of Israel. For he is the living God, and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. That's the gospel of the kingdom. He delivereth and rescueth. That's the gospel of the name of Jesus Christ, in a sense, isn't it? And he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. He's taken his servant from the grip of death and delivered him. You know, my dear brothers and sisters, over those 127 provinces, there would have been an enormous gospel extension effort. Money was no problem. It was by the king's signature. And that went into all the passages of the kingdom. What a thrilling chapter. He was an old man. You know, just recently I had the privilege of visiting an old man. He's in fact over 90. And although he hasn't had such good cognizance mentally in recent times, we did have the opportunity of spending about an hour with him. You all know him very well. And you know, for all of that hour, all he spoke to us about was what a great man Jesus Christ was. A really great man. Oh, he said, he is a great man. Can you hear him? And he said, you know, he loves us. He wants us to be saved. It was very, very emotional, to say the least. He's not known for saying too many words together. But for almost an hour, he continued in that vein. It was very moving indeed. A man who's been signal in faith in your area, and which even in other lands is greatly loved for what he's meant. He does it the same as he aforetime did. He's an unchanged person. So we're very privileged, aren't we, sometimes, to see that in our older brethren playing a Daniel-like role, speaking about the love of Christ for his people and his love of the brotherhood, about his love for the kingdom. Oh, he said, eternal life. Can you imagine it? No more pain. Live forever. And tears came to his eyes. That's the gospel of the kingdom and life, isn't it, my dear brothers and sisters? Is he dead? Will he die? Well, he will die if Christ isn't here in the near future. But he will live. The power of what is provided for us and the things we have, my dear brothers and sisters, is just truly wondrous, truly wondrous. We're just on the brink, surely. Earthquakes in Japan, earthquakes in Christchurch, the Middle East, just a ring of fire, isn't it? We're in a world of tremendous turmoil. It just seems to me this morning, my dear brothers and sisters, we do the same thing. We take the bread and we take the wine and we think about what it means. That we keep what it means in our hearts. And we do as we've always done. Love the brotherhood and work for its salvation. Love the truth and be loyal to it in all the things that we do. Until our master is here, and the Lord, the world might laugh. They will laugh at what we are about and what we mean. In the end, some will yet turn. You know, I heard a remarkable story of a person who was doing just that recently. And the doctor came. And the husband was very ill from a serious disease. A disease that was something you couldn't really get over. And the doctor said, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And the wife said, "I want you to give him enough life, if you can, that he can be alive until the coming of the Lord." But the treatment was disastrous, but it was successful. And just last Saturday, he returned to his town early from an appointment over here. Do you know why he wanted to go? Not because he didn't love being here, but he wanted to go to the baptism of the doctor. That wife spoke up, didn't she? She said that her hope rested in that. And he said, "You must be religious." So last Saturday, he went home for the baptism on the Sunday of the doctor. The gospel of the kingdom prevails. And so does our fight with death. It will prevail, and we shall be there if we do as we have aforetime. Thank you.